My name is Nicholas Ivor Martin. I'm the Director of Operations at Lyric Opera of Chicago. And today, I'm speaking to you about Johann Strauss Jr.'s best-known operetta, Die Fledermaus. The excerpts you will hear are taken from an EMI recording, featuring Nikolai Gedda as Gabriel von Eisenstein, Anneliese Rothenberger as Rosalinda, Renata Holm as Adele, Brigitte Fassbender as Prince Orlovsky, Adolf de la Pozza as Alfred, and Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau as Dr. Falke. Willy Boskowski conducts the Vienna Staatsoper Orchestra and Chorus, and special thanks to EMI for providing the musical excerpts. The operatic form has long been an omnivore, gobbling up other art forms to feed itself, dance, painting, symphony, and architecture, just to name a few. Singing for that long is hungry work. But opera is not just an omnivore. She's also a cannibal. Got a local musical form that looks and smells like opera, but's just a little bit different? Singspiel, say, or opera comique, or Gesamtkunstwerk, or grand opera. Historically, one of three things always seem to happen. Sometimes, as the unsuspecting victim works its way down the digestive tract of the mainstream opera world, its name becomes so general that it is no longer really different from opera. Opéra comique was born in 18th century France to satirical vaudevilles popular at street fairs. The performers would take well-known songs, write new words, and incorporate them into the satire. Then composers began writing new songs, still retaining spoken dialogue. Eventually, the term became so diluted it was no longer different than its literal translation, comic opera. Actually, even that wasn't always true. The most famous opera comique in the repertoire is that laugh riot, Bizet's Carmen. Carmen is an opera comique because by the 19th century, the term had come to mean not much more than a musical performance with spoken dialogue, rather than sung recitative, and one performed at the Opéra Comique, the name given to a theater in Paris by royal edict in 1870. Sometimes, opera didn't even leave the bones of the form it was consuming. The victim disappeared completely. Singspiel started in 17th century Germany, based on miracle plays, using ballads and text to tell a folk story, possibly with supernatural elements. The two most famous ones? Mozart's Magic Flute and his abduction from the Seraglio. And that's about where Singspiel ended, unless you count the occasional history buff and oddball like Kurt Weill. In preparation for his monumental 20th century opera, The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, Weill decided to do a smaller piece, almost like the study that a Renaissance sculptor would do. This little Mahagoni he called a Singspiel. And then there's Wagner, the composer who breaks all metaphors. When his Gesamtkunstwerk, or total work of art, was ingested by opera, it changed the eater. Gesamtkunstwerk was about synthesizing all art forms into a single, integrated whole. But several aspects of his special form became de rigueur for serious composers who followed him. Almost all modern opera is now through-composed. That is, the music starts at the beginning and plays through to the act curtain, rather than stopping to delineate individual songs or allow time for spoken dialogue. The lights are turned out in theaters during the performance, also thanks to Wagner's persnicketiness. Until he came along, audiences not only expected to be able to read the program while people were singing, they also paid visits to friends in nearby boxes, bought refreshments, gossiped, and sometimes engaged in more energetic activities. But opera was always the one that walked away from any encounter with another musical theater form. Almost no one after Wagner dared to call his own opera a Gesamtkunstwerk. Wagner's musical disciples were surprisingly shy about comparing themselves to the master, who himself developed megalomania to a level outstanding even among artists. Whatever the outcome for the digestee, opera stumbles to her feet and lumbers away. But what of the dishes? There are myriad opera comiques still in the active repertoire, but only a handful of singspiels. What then to make of the family of which Strauss's Die Fledermaus is the best-known member? If you think, as many people do, that the term operetta is so generic that there must be thousands being performed every day, then I challenge you to name some. There is Franz Lehár's The Merry Widow, Wiener Blut, A Night in Venice by Strauss, La Belle Hélène by Offenbach. Gilbert and Sullivan double that number with just their best-known works, Trial by Jury, HMS Pinafore, The Pirates of Penzance, The Mikado, and The Gondoliers. French and Italian comic opera are not generally called operetta, nor are American musicals for all the similarities. Most operettas derive from the Parisian tradition of light satire made famous by Jacques Offenbach, and most were born in one of three cities, Paris, London, or Vienna. There are thousands of true operettas, but outside of Germany and France, the number that see regular performances is modest. Why? Essentially, the dearth of operettas can be blamed on the fact that, like opéra comique, operettas were born from the French vaudeville. When diehard opera lovers sneer at operetta for being too light, they're not just being snobby. Many operettas were disposable in the sense that they were written in haste and cobbled together from existing material. This was a popular entertainment created to make money. In this, it was similar to British ballad opera, of which the most famous example was the Beggar's Opera, composed by John Gay and directed by John Rich. Contemporary wags said that the proceeds from the piece made Gay rich and Rich gay. The fact that there was money to be made encouraged competition, but it also encouraged haste and copycats. Write two operettas in half the time and get paid twice as much. And if this season's hit is a musical about a talking dog, write one about a talking cat. The immortal words of playwright, gunrunner, and Figaro inventor Pierre-Augustin Caron de Beaumarchais become only too true. That which is too stupid to be spoken is sung. The music could sometimes be equally formulaic. Offenbach and Gilbert and Sullivan distinguished themselves from the bulk of operatic composers by their brilliance with words and with tunes. But great as Sullivan's scores are, neither he, Strauss, nor Offenbach, the three greatest operatic composers, were known as deep orchestrators. They wrote catchy tunes, and the orchestration sometimes had to see for itself. But most importantly, the vaudevilles were topical satire, parodying politicians, society, and stuffy institutions of the day. One of Offenbach's greatest operettas, La Belle Hélène, when it is done today, must first be translated to make clear all of the references that the audiences no longer get. Ostensibly, it's a parody of Paris and Helen's elopement that triggered the Trojan War. But everyone in the audience at the premiere knew it was a send-up of people and institutions from Napoleon III's contemporary Second Empire. As composer Camille Saint-Saëns explained it, operetta is, quote, the daughter of opéra comique who went astray. And then as an afterthought, he admitted, not that daughters who go astray are always without their charms. Strauss's Fledermaus avoided the traps that doomed lesser operettas. The plot is silly. Comedian Victor Borge once summarized Die Fledermaus thus. As the curtain goes up, we see an empty room in the Eisenstein house. This is a crucial moment in the operetta because it's the last time anybody knows for sure what's going on. After that, the plot is one mass of confusion, with mistaken identities, people making love to their own wives, and other absurdities. The premise of the operetta seems to be that if you've had enough champagne, you won't notice the holes in the plot. Well, darn the holes in the plot. Strauss wrote some of his most marvelous music for Die Fledermaus, including a laughing song, a drinking song, and a Hungarian csárdás, which is something like a polka if you limp a little. And that's what counts. As Borger reminds us, the music is infectiously tuneful, but the story is also zany and entertaining. And finally, Die Fledermaus, like Viennese operetta generally, eschewed the extreme topical political and social satire of French operetta in favor of romance and sentimentality. That waltz right in the middle of the overture is no accident. Strauss was not primarily an opera or theater composer, but rather a dance band leader. The son of Vienna's most famous dance band leader and composer, and brother to two other dance composers, Josef Strauss and Eduard Strauss. Johann Strauss Sr., the father, had formed his own orchestra, capitalizing on the increasing popularity of public balls. You would pay an admittance fee to a dance hall, or band leader, and then you could spend the evening dancing to the latest popular Strauss waltz. Strauss was not only one of the first to charge admission to his entertainments, he also shrewdly started giving his waltzes names, so patrons who later wanted to buy the sheet music could identify what they were asking for, his most famous composition being the Radetzky March. Strauss Sr. and Strauss Jr. did not agree about the younger man's future. Sr. wanted Jr. to be a banker. Jr. wanted to go into the family business. But when Sr. abandoned the family to go off with his mistress, his ability to influence his son evaporated. The two would be famous professional rivals. For all of Johann Sr.'s fame, it would be his son, the so-called Waltz King, who would forever link the waltz with the city of Vienna in the public mind. Having started as a folk dance, the waltz was the rage of 19th century Europe, and in a way that might make more sense to us today if we think of the 1920s and the Charleston than of ballroom dance. The waltz in three-quarter time, that is, three beats per measure, was not a stately thing. It was sexy and risque, with partners dancing so close together that it scandalized contemporary stick-in-the-muds. The racy nature of the waltz itself is mirrored from the first in Die Fledermaus, which opens in the house of its hero, Gabriele von Eisenstein. Eisenstein has been sentenced to serve 8 days in jail for insulting a public official. He doesn't want to go, of course, and without telling his wife, he conspires with his friend Falke to skip prison and instead attend a ball hosted by Prince Orlovsky. The Eisenstein's pretty maid, Adele, is going to the same ball on the invitation of her sister, and she, too, lies to Mrs. Eisenstein about her plans. She says her aunt is very sick and she needs to visit her. If Adele sounds like the housemaid of French and British farce, she is. Viennese operetta derived very explicitly from French operetta, and Fledermaus is in part a reworked translation of a French vaudeville, Réveillon, by Henri Meillac and Ludovic Halévy. Those names may be familiar. Together, they wrote the librettos for Offenbach's most successful operettas, and in their spare time did the libretto for Bizet's Carmen. The title, Réveillon, is the name given to the supper that Frenchmen would throw on Christmas or New Year's Eve. Think of the English word reveille, the bugle or trumpet that wakes up the troops, and you realize where the term comes from. The dinner was meant to keep you up. It went on forever because the point was to entertain everyone until midnight to welcome in the holiday. With operetta, it always comes back to food. Both Eisenstein and Adele have lied to Mrs. Eisenstein, her first name is Rosalinda, about where they are going. But before you feel too sorry for her, Rosalinda's lover, the singing teacher Alfred, turns up for their own late-night supper. He's a tenor. Enough said? Except in the French play, he's a crazy band leader who conducts wildly while simultaneously playing his violin. Having done this himself in real life, Strauss apparently didn't find it as amusing as his fans did. The act ends with the prison warden, Frank, showing up to collect Eisenstein. Since Rosalinda cannot properly explain Alfred's presence late at night in her boudoir, the two agree that Alfred must pretend to be her husband and go to jail in Eisenstein's place. The act ends with Alfred toasting his mistress in a champagne drinking song. One of the critics at the 1874 premiere no doubt thought he was being enormously clever when he pronounced the champagne aria flat. But audiences disagreed.
Trinke, Liebchen, trinke schnell, trinken macht die Augen hell, sind die schönen Äuglein klar, siehst du alles licht und wahr. leise lieb ein Traum, der uns erzählt. Siehst, wie ewige Treue schaut, so was gibt's nicht mehr.
The setting for Act Two is Prince Orlovsky's home, site of the ball that everyone in Act One was lying about attending. This is the confusing act. First, the prince is a woman, or at least he's played by one. If you're thinking this is merely an operatic convention, like Mozart's trouser role Cherubino, or Richard Strauss's character Octavian in Der Rosenkavalier, you're half right. It is a trouser role. But Cherubino and Octavian are played by women because their characters are both pubescent boys. The casting is a way of demonstrating their youth. That's not the case with Orlovsky. Instead, the casting is meant to be racy and funny. French operetta, and therefore to a lesser extent its Austrian descendant, was wild for cross-dressing. For an operetta set in a Paris produce market, Offenbach brought down the house by casting two burly men as female vegetable sellers. Offenbach's games with casting went further. He parodied the Greek myth of Leda being raped by Zeus in the form of a swan by changing the swan to a flea, and then casting a really heavy singer to play the flea. When the more established opera companies convinced the authorities in Paris to limit by law the number of performers in small venues to no more than four singers, Offenbach wrote an operetta with a fifth character who's mute, except during a quintet, when he barks and grunts. To Strauss's opening night audience, another confusing element would have been the costuming. Today we don't stop to think about the fact that Fledermaus is set at the time of its premiere, but contemporary audiences, who were expecting lavish spectacle and period costumes, noticed. Strauss and his librettist appeased their audience's concerns by making Act Two a costume ball. For at least one act, you would not be looking at the same clothes worn by the audience in the boxes. What would not have surprised contemporary audiences, but does surprise modern audiences, is the lack of a definitive version of the act. Strauss wrote a large number of dances and songs, many of them on national themes. The Hungarian folk song, the Csárdás, is one of the few pieces that is always done, since it is Rosalinda's attempt to prove that she is the Hungarian countess she claims to be. It's common practice to interpolate popular songs from other sources, other Strauss waltzes, whatever music inspires a producer's fancy, into the act. If all that isn't confusing enough, there's the plot. It turns out the entire ball is a setup for Eisenstein's friend Falke to work out his revenge for a previous practical joke. The year before the opera takes place, Eisenstein apparently took Falke to a costume ball dressed as a bat, got him drunk, and then abandoned him in the town square. Falke woke up the next morning in his costume, surrounded by the citizenry, who laughed him into a funk. This is the source of the operetta's title, Fledermaus, meaning bat. With Orlovsky's help, Falke has invited Eisenstein's wife, his maid, and his prison warden to the ball, and it being a costume ball, all three have shown up in disguise. Rosalinda as the Hungarian countess, Adela as an actress, and Frank as a chevalier. Eisenstein recognizes Adela, or thinks he does, but her laughing song and the protestations of his friends convince him he must be mistaken. Es ist auch hier, Trumpet sein sie, wenn ich lache. Rosalinda, who is more than happy to play a joke on her husband, seduces him and makes him give her his pocket watch, which he does before staggering off to his appointment with the jail cell. We've talked about the authors of the play on which Die Fledermaus was based, but to turn it into an operetta in German, Strauss needed librettists. He turned to Karl Hofner and Richard Genet. Genet was the more important partner, and his reason for breaking the piece into three acts was not entirely artistic. As was typical of Vienna at the time, Genet's librettist contract paid him so much per act, so three acts, even a relatively short third act, were better than two. It also gave scope to the operetta's most important non-singing character, Frosch the jailer. In Frank's absence, Frosch has managed his own little party, and the act opens with his unscripted drunken antics as Orlovsky's party guests descend upon his little jail. When Adele and her sister Irene show up looking for Frank, who they still think is a chevalier, Frosch locks them up. Meanwhile, Alfred wants to get out of jail. He's tired of pretending to be Rosalinda's husband. And Rosalinda wants a divorce. She produces Eisenstein's purloined watch as evidence of his infidelity. Only Falke's arrival with the rest of Orlovsky's guests clears things up. It has all been a practical joke, revenge for Eisenstein's bat prank the year before. Eisenstein blames it all on champagne, and while the excuse does not save him from serving jail time, it does buy him a reprieve from his wife, as well as providing a frothy ending to the operetta.